We'll call the next case, U.S. versus Pineda, Buenaventura, and that's case number 09-1500. We'll just wait a moment so that the, not that they didn't want to hear you, Mr. Handelsman. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Robert Handelsman for Teodulo Pineda Buenaventura. I think there's more than one Pineda Buenaventura involved in this case. So the quantity, we calculate 429 grams. The government did not prove more by reliable evidence. A probation officer's guess out of thin air is not reliable evidence.
Well, the PSR attributes between 400 and 500 grams to Teodulo and says that's a conservative estimate. Did your client challenge that finding?
I didn't represent him below, but as you can see from the transcript of the sentencing and the so-called objections to the PSR was not challenged below. This is strictly a plain error issue. But the government says you can consider a total amount involved in the conspiracy to find the 500 grams. There is no evidence and no finding that any more than the 429 grams was jointly undertaken criminal activity as per 1B1.3A1B. The government doesn't realize what you said in Soto Piedra. The scope of relevant conduct is not necessarily the scope of the entire conspiracy, and the government's contention is contrary to your recent opinion in Salem.
I'm very familiar with that, Counsel.
So am I. The next issue is whether the merits were forfeited or waived. There's no waiver here because a failure to argue this very obvious issue is not shown by this record to be deliberate or strategic.
Well, let me go back in terms of this calculation between 400 and 500 grams. There are, at least in the PSR, I think, makes reference to 22 additional deliveries. And the fact that those could have moved the number over 500. I mean, there's enough in the record to get to the 500 number. Your big issue is the district court didn't spell it out or make any findings to make those totals.
Not quite, because I think those 22 deliveries were to 300 grams, as I recall from the PSR. I'll take a look at it after I sit down. But I think those 22 deliveries constituted to 300 grams. And we find 429. If the quantity was 429.9999, the statutory minimum would not apply here. And he'd receive a guideline sentence. That's the thing that we're concerned about. We concede in the brief, there's 429.28 grams. Where did the government find the difference? Or where did the probation officer find the difference? She guessed at it. Now, this issue wasn't omitted, so another argument could be made. This is negligence, pure and simple. And if you have any doubt about forfeiture versus waiver, you have to find forfeiture. And there is obvious plain error here. There would have been a lower sentence if the sentencing quantity was 429 grams. Any error causing an increased sentence, no matter how small the increase, is prejudicial. Thank you.
Ms. Keister?
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. My issue is different from that raised by Mr. Handelsman. As the Court is aware, I am challenging for the first time before this Court the knowing and voluntary nature of Mr. Mendoza's plea. And I would submit that because the Rule 11 errors and violations in this case were so numerous and so egregious and so patently evident from the face of the plea hearing transcript that this Court can certainly entertain this issue under a plain error review. I'd like to focus, because my time...
Let me go back just so there was no effort to withdraw the plea before sentencing.
That's correct.
Which, of course, would have been helpful.
Clearly.
Go ahead.
This court, in the Fernandez case, did indicate specifically that Rule 11 violations, because those protections are so important, can never be waived. They can, in fact, be forfeited. I submit that that's what happened here. Clearly, I'd rather be here on a different standard of review than plain error. But I think the totality of the circumstances here are it's abysmal. You look at this record, and it's evident that Mr. Mendoza, first and foremost, did not know he was going to be sentenced to a 5-year minimum mandatory sentence of imprisonment. He has to be told that. That's clear under Rule 11. And although he is apprised of the fact by the district court judge that that could happen, it's in no way spelled out that it would happen. And she never said to this defendant, you understand that if you enter this plea and I accept it, you're going to prison for 5 years. And, in fact, if you look at what the court does say in plea transcript, and I draw the court's attention to page 10 of that transcript, it's page 19 in my appendix, the judge says to Mr. Mendoza, do you understand that if I accept your plea and adjudge you guilty, you could be subject to penalties up to and including the maximum that Mr. Connell went over a few minutes ago, and that is a minimum sentence of 5 years, a maximum of 40, and a fine? And she goes on from there, and the defendant says yes. And then the court says, do you understand that when I sentence you, I can give you any sentence not exceeding the statutory maximum? She never says to him, do you understand you're going to get 5 years? She goes into a recitation of the guidelines and the fact that they're advisory and there will be various factors that she'll entertain at sentencing, but he's not told he's going to get those 5 years. I think that's the most egregious of the violations here. The other one I think is particularly prominent is the fact that it appears from the record that Mr. Mendoza does not understand the charge to which he's pleading. He doesn't understand what a conspiracy is. He keeps trying to inform the court that he didn't know these people. I didn't agree with these people. I don't know who these people are. All I did was sell on a couple of occasions. So although he may have been distributing or been guilty of possession with intent to distribute, he's attempting to tell the court, I didn't conspire, but that's a charge to which he pleads. And, again, under Rule 11, that's something that needs to be understood, firmly understood. And I think under all these circumstances, particularly in light of the fact that Mr. Mendoza spoke no English, had a sixth-grade education, everything was being filtered through an interpreter, the audio system appeared to be down, the case appears to me to be very much on all fours with the Fernandez case, where that plea was withdrawn by this court.
Well, let me ask you this, and then we'll get back to Fernandez. Was the written plea agreement translated for him?
That I do not know.
Because that's not clear from you. Don't know that.
I don't know that.
And then in terms of Fernandez, isn't this case different? Because in that case, no one could tell the acts that the defendant was admitting. Here, Mendoza specifically admitted that he delivered drugs for Efren. Why isn't that enough?
I don't think that's enough for conspiracy. He's not admitting to any of the elements of the conspiracy. And
so what's missing?
That there was an agreement. There's the scope of the conspiracy is not fleshed out. We don't know what, even if he's selling, we don't know who he's selling for, although he's inconsistent. On the one hand, he says he sold for Ephraim. In another part of the colloquy, he says, I sold for some other guy, and I don't even know who he was. So it's not clear who he's selling for, if he's agreeing with anybody to make sales. There's no foundation here in the facts to tell us what he's agreeing that he did. It's not clear to me from the recitation by the prosecutor that that's outlined. And it's not clear to me that Mr. Mendoza agrees to any of those facts.
Well, his exact words were, well, they called me and had me, Efren called me to have me take that over to someone who I guess had ordered it from him. I don't know how they ordered this stuff from him. You don't think there's enough to infer from that that there was an agreement to pick it up and then take it to somebody else based on what Efren asked?
I think it's ambiguous in this context because he's talking about taking or picking up DVDs. He's not explicitly talking about drugs. There's a lot of conversation happening here with respect to who is doing what and what, in fact, the acts are to which he's admitting.
Any other questions?
No. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelleher.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Megan Kelleher, and I represent the defendant appellant, Gerardo Pineda-Soria. And I am here on, again, a separate issue from Ms. Kistner and Mr. Handelsman. We are challenging the district court's denial of a motion to suppress evidence and statements made by Mr. Soria, stemming from the execution of a search warrant in Janesville, Wisconsin. And if I may, I'd like to briefly touch on the consent issue and then move on to the inevitable discovery doctrine, which obviously under these facts is more prevalent. It's conceded by the government. It's admitted by the magistrate judge below that the initial search of apartment B was illegal. It was made without a warrant. The Janesville police officers, along with the Wisconsin special agents from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, executed a search warrant that specifically said gave the officers authority to search the residence at 253 South High Street.
Right, and it was for apartment A, and it turns out everybody was in B, so they were in the wrong place, and then they took him to the station. You don't have that much time. I want to get to the heart of it. What do you think that the police should have done that they didn't do to get consent from your client? Because one of your arguments is that his consent when he was at the police station was not voluntary.
Correct.
So what more should the police have done? They ultimately got oral agreement, and then they got a written agreement.
Our position is that that consent was not voluntary. Mr. Soria was arrested in his bedroom as he was taken out. He witnessed many agents and police officers entering his room. He was then taken to a station where he was interrogated by two officers. He does not speak English. He's a 22-year-old native of Mexico, and he also has no criminal background.
What about the consent of the two occupants?
It's our position, Judge, that the two occupants had no authority to give consent. There are no facts in the record that the police did any type of diligent investigation as to whether these occupants of apartment B did have common authority over the apartment. One even stated to the officer that he didn't pay rent. No ID was asked of these occupants.
Well, but that it's a possessory interest, isn't it? The paying a rent might be some evidence of that, but that wouldn't necessarily be fatal, would it?
Perhaps not, but it's our position that they didn't even inquire. Just because two people are found in an apartment sleeping doesn't necessarily mean that they do, in fact, have common authority over the apartment enough to give consent to search.
But the officers can ask the explicit question, but circumstantially, can't they infer, because they found the other two sleeping up there, that they had some authority?
It's our position, Judge, that no, there was not enough in the record for them to even infer that they have to go farther than just assuming that people sleeping in an apartment have actual authority to give consent to search.
So let's move to this inevitable discovery, because they had the warrant initially, discovered they were in the wrong place in A rather than B. So why wouldn't it be logical that they could have just gone back and gotten the search warrant amended to deal with apartment B?
I have two points on that issue. Number one is that The inevitable discovery doctrine, as you know, states that if the government can prove by a preponderance of the evidence that officers would have discovered the evidence by lawful means, even the illegally seized items are considered will not be suppressed. In this instance, there are other circuits that have held that discovery of unlawful evidence is not inevitable evidence if the evidence might have been removed, destroyed, before police can pursue an independent investigation. Now, I have these cases from the 10th Circuit and 9th Circuit, United States versus Owens, United States versus Boatwright, unfortunately aren't cited in my brief, but I submit them to you today to say that the police detained the occupants down on the first level. The two occupants were not arrested. They weren't under arrest. There is a slight chance that during, first of all, we also do not know how long it would have taken to secure a new warrant. There's no evidence in the record that they would have gotten it immediately. And there's also no, we submit that the government can't meet its burden because there is a possibility that the evidence could have been destroyed or removed somehow during their postponement of the search while they obtained a new warrant.
Do you mind?
No, go ahead.
Apartment B, counsel, was above apartment A, was that right?
Yes, Judge.
And the law enforcement people had control of apartment A and effectively controlled the ingress and egress of to the building, including apartment B.
Presumably, Judge.
Well, I think a pretty strong inference in the record. I mean, that was the subject, the target of the search, and that's where the officers directed their attention.
Yes, I would agree with that. And if the court finds that agrees with the government that a search warrant of apartment B would have been easily obtained, I submit that while the evidence would have been found, the evidence, the paraphernalia, and the drugs in the bedroom would have been found pursuant to a new search warrant of apartment B, the statements, incriminating statements made by Mr. Soria later would not be subject to the inevitable discovery doctrine.
I guess what I was driving at is it's reasonable to conclude that the law enforcement people would have conducted a kind of a Terry stop on anybody trying to come down those stairs and get out the building, and a pretty good inference that they would have stopped any contraband from being removed from the building, don't you think?
I can't say for sure based on this record, but I mean that's a
fair
very
inference,
good
excuse me.
Possibility.
All right.
So
thank you.
No further questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Connell.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Paul Connell. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. I was responsible for the prosecution of all three defendants below. Why don't I start with Mr. Pineda Soria? The sole issue in his case is whether the district court erred when it denied his motion to suppress. This court conducts de novo review of a district court's legal conclusions. Factual findings are reviewed for clear error. Here the district court did not err when it denied the motion to suppress. The district court found that the defendant voluntarily consented to a search of his residence before any contraband was found and found that the defendant's co-tenants voluntarily consented before any contraband was found. Either of those.
So, terms of the second search of apartment B, it was after the co-tenants gave consent and the consent from.
That's correct, Judge Williams.
Both consents were in their hands.
Correct. They had verbal consent from both co-tenants by 6:45 in the morning. That's clear from the record. And that would have allowed the police at that point to go back in. But they waited until they heard back from the agents who were interviewing the defendant at the police station to see if he had granted consent yet. And they waited until another officer came down and translated in Spanish a consent to search form for the co-tenants. They both signed off, and at that point, the officers went back in with the search team with a drug dog, and at that point, that's when the contraband was found.
And why don't you respond to her argument that they had no basis for concluding or insufficient basis, I would say, that these were actually co-tenants who had some authority to sign.
Well, first, I would point out the district court found below that they were co-tenants, and that was not objected to below. So those arguments that are raised now on appeal, as I point out in my brief, have been waived. They were found sleeping there. There was the bedroom. There was a kind of a common room with a pool table. There were, you know, more than one dresser. Judge Williams, there weren't a lot of facts developed below because it wasn't raised by Mr. Pineda-Soria at any point. And my recollection is the affidavit that he filed in support of his motion to suppress talks about, I think, that he lived there with his brother and friend. That's my best recollection. It's in the record. I couldn't cite you, but it would be attached to his motion to suppress. The factual findings by the district court below with regard to the consents are based on uncontested and credible testimony by law enforcement officers. Mr. Pineda-Soria did not call any witnesses below at his suppression hearing. All he did was, through his lawyer, cross-examine the officers, and the court correctly found that they were credible with regard to the timing and the consent, and that no contraband was found during that very, very brief initial foray into the wrong apartment relative to the warrant, however, the correct apartment relative to wanting to arrest the defendant.
Did you represent the government during the motion to suppress, counsel?
I did, Your Honor. Let me just briefly turn to inevitable discovery, and then I'll move on to the other defendants in this case. The only thing that we would have had to have added to the second warrant was the fact that it turns out that he did not live in apartment A. He lived upstairs in apartment B. And we just would have appended probably three more paragraphs of a new affidavit to the existing documents we provided to the magistrate, and that would have been it. And the record is clear from the suppression hearing. The DEA agent on scene, Special Agent Becca, almost immediately upon realizing that the defendant didn't live in the lower apartment, he lived in the upper apartment, had everybody withdraw and talk to another DEA agent on scene, Special Agent Grywalski, that he was going to go try to get consent, and if not, they were already thinking they would get a second warrant. So the officers were immediately on top of this and doing the right thing.
That evidence came out at that suppression hearing that they were contemplating that there were actually two things they were going to do: try to get the consent, and in the alternative, get a warrant.
Actually, three, because it would be consent from the defendant or his co-tenants and or co-tenants, and then fresh paper, Your Honor, yeah. Mm-hmm. Unless there are questions for me about Mr. Pineda-Soria, I would ask the court to affirm his conviction and sentence. And I'll turn to Mr. Mendoza. The sole issue in his case is whether he entered a knowing and voluntary guilty plea. Judge Williams, as you point out, he never moved to withdraw it below, so it is subject to plain error review. Subject to the four-part plain error test, that is, there must be error, the error must be obvious, it must affect substantial rights, and then only if those first three prongs are met, then this court has the ability to exercise its discretion to notice the error if the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. Here I would respectfully submit there was no error in the first instance. It was not the world's smoothest guilty plea. There's no doubt about it. You're working through a translator both on the phone, and then counsel below also has a translator that he brings with him to things like this. And he was there.
There was no, I'm curious, there was no break when, or no suggestion that there be a break when it was clear after two attempts the district court wasn't understanding the district court on this conspiracy concept, where there could have been a break. He could have gone out with his lawyer, with the interpreter, gotten everything sorted out and come back. Because the district court, in fact, said, you know, I'm just not going to take this plea if this doesn't go forward, which concerns me a little because it could be viewed by the defendant as a little intimidating, knowing what's at stake and then being told by the district court, you know, I'm not even going to take this plea. We've tried twice. It's not working. Let's move on. Let's go to trial.
Sure. I appreciate your question, Your Honor, and this is where I think a cold record is not as effective as actually having been there.
But that's all we have, counsel.
Right, I understand, Your Honor, but you have to appreciate, you know, you being a district judge, you have no interest in having a guilty plea get all screwed up and then having it come up on appeal on plein air review. And
that's a fair statement.
Yes.
Yeah. I was a district judge, so I was definitely my big interest.
Yes, Your Honor. You know, she's there. The defendant, several times during the course of the plea hearing, she stated you should not be pleading guilty if you don't want to accept responsibility. If you don't think they can prove this, you should not plead guilty. And then Judge Williams, finally, by the end, you know, she, you know, had it gone on for, I think, beyond the 20 minutes that Judge Crabb allocates for guilty pleas in the Western District. That's about how long they take.
Even with interpreters?
Maybe a little longer with interpreters, but
excuse me, did you say there's a time allocation for
Well, she schedules matters like this about every 20 minutes
I
for
see.
Pleas and sentencing. But if one goes long, it's no great shakes. It's just it goes a little long. But the defendant was really, I think, more afraid than anything, Your Honor, Judge Williams, of admitting the facts in light of all the violence in Mexico related to the drug trade. That is what we saw with several defendants in this case. If I actually could turn to Mr. Pineda-Soria, since he's a co-defendant in this case, his sentencing transcript is part of the record. He actually had a brother and another relative who was killed in Mexico in light of what happened in this case, the search at his place and so forth. So I think that did spread throughout. The word got to all the defendants in the case. And that was my sense, Your Honor, of Mr. Mendoza. He did want to plead guilty. He did not want to go to trial. Judge Crabb made that clear to him several times. And she wasn't trying to press him to plead guilty. She was trying to press him to make a decision, not use up any more of the court's time. If he wanted to accept responsibility and wanted to plead guilty, this was his chance to do that. And what I would say is, looking at the totality of it all, if you ignore what I call kind of the white noise in the middle, from the point where she says to him, well, in your own words, tell me what you did, and where it all sort of starts to get a little bollocked up and he doesn't want to admit it, to the point where she says, well, we'll just set this matter for trial, and then he finally does admit, yes, Efren called me, he had me take a package over to, it was the very end of the transcript that you were talking to Ms. Kister about earlier.
In the plea agreement, did it spell out the factual basis for the charge? Was that in the plea agreement?
No, that's not in there. That's not our standard practice in our district to include that. I always provide it to the defendant and his attorney ahead of time.
Well, don't you think it would be helpful if it was laid out in the plea agreement what the factual basis was for the charge? I mean, even if the language didn't say, and this is everything that we have, but just laid it out so that, you know, when it's, especially when you're dealing with an interpreter.
I agree.
I mean,
I would add, Your Honor, though, after I put in my factual basis, when Judge Crabb turned to the defendant and said, did you hear what Mr. Connell said? Do you agree with it? He says, I think what he said is fair. He did understand it. He did agree with it. And then at the very end, when he finally admits to his conduct in the conspiracy, I think that is sufficient. Again, this was not the world's cleanest plea, but I think there is enough in the record. It is different enough from Fernandez for this court to find that it should not notice the error here. There was no error, and it does not need to notice the error under the plein air review. And unless there are additional questions about Mr. Mendoza, I'll turn to...
Well, certainly the district court could have clarified after he said he had sold, that he had taken this drugs from somebody else and then gave it to somebody else who was involved or had more questions, so it would be clear he understood the conspiracy, the concept of agreeing with somebody.
Right, and I think that
made a better record.
It circles back, I think, to what Judge Crabb tried to do a little earlier, talking about if A is acts in concert with B and so forth, and I think she didn't want to go down that road again in light of the fact that the defendant had sort of finally crossed the bridge and was willing to admit his role in the conspiracy.
Yeah, but going down that road again might have made our job a lot easier, because then we would have known exactly what it is he was agreeing to. All right, let's move on to Teodulo. Yeah, because there's a big problem here, I think, because the district court didn't explicitly find that it was 500 grams. In fact, the court said, quote, your relevant conduct involves at least 400 grams, but less than 500 grams of cocaine.
Counsel, I think that problem's exacerbated by the supplemental authority that was provided by Mr. Teodulo's lawyer of the Salem case. Maybe you could comment on that as well, and
sure.
The additional requirement of making a finding that the relevant conduct was part of a jointly undertaken criminal activity.
I do agree with you first, Judge Williams, that Judge Crabb, at the conclusion of the sentencing, did not use what you'd call the magic words and make a finding about this was the scope of the conspiracy. Your personal relative conduct is, and we'll just use Mr. Handelman's number, 429 grams. In addition, I find it was reasonably foreseeable for you to have known that your co-conspirator, Efren Pineda Buenaventura, had in his possession and was going to provide to you or to others the 171 grams found at his house, the 599 grams in a storage locker. She did not make those specific findings. There's no doubt about
it. Right. So it was not even magic words. She didn't utter the words, period. This totals this, therefore it's over 500 grams, therefore you're in mandatory land.
Right. What I would point out to the court is, first of all, our first argument with regard to Mr. Pineda Buenaventura is that he waived this issue. His plea agreement calls for him to get a 60-month mandatory minimum. He had agreed with his plea hearing. It was a 60-month mandatory minimum crime. Never objected at sentencing. But he did file some objections and clarifications. But I would turn the court's attention to two things that his lawyer said at sentencing. First, when Judge Crabb inquired, "You're not contesting what happened here?" And his lawyer says, no, we've pled to the charges. But then on page 9, and I think this is in the appendix to the brief that we filed, my supplemental appendix, but it's on page 9 of the sentencing transcript, the reason we didn't object, he says words to the effect of, the reason we did not object to the quantity is it would not have affected the outcome, which is tantamount to agreeing that the government has proven, the PSR has enough in it, that the conspiracy involved at least 500 grams, which is what matters here, not the defendant's personal relevant conduct, but that the conspiracy involved at least 500 grams, and that the facts that are in there that tie this defendant, Teodolo Pineda Buenaventura, to his brother, Efren Pineda Buenaventura, who was a named co-conspirator but not a defendant in this indictment, that's tantamount to saying, well, it was within what Efren had on the same day that he was caught as the defendant, that 177 grams at his house, the 599 grams at the storage locker, would have been within the scope of the conspiracy, and it was foreseeable to this defendant. So
let me go back to the plea agreement, because in the plea agreement or at the plea hearing, he didn't specifically acknowledge the 500-gram amount, did he?
That is my shortcoming, that I didn't just say one more thing.
So,
and Judge, there would have been...
Part of what you're doing is building on what happened at the plea agreement, but that didn't happen at the plea agreement. The judge didn't say at the plea agreement, therefore, this triggers mandatory minimum, 5 years, right? You'll get 5 years?
There is a point when she says, you understand the government's charging you with at least 500 grams, which is the trigger point for the five-year mandatory minimum.
And did she say that with the trigger point being a mandatory five-year minimum? I understand she said you're being charged with 500 grams, right? He acknowledged that. Is that right?
He acknowledged after I stated the maximum penalties, she confirmed that he understood what the maximum, and I think she does circle back and say, and it carries a mandatory minimum. I didn't bring the transcript up here, Your Honor, but it would be within the first three pages of the.
So your recollection is she said that, and that carries a mandatory 5 year minimum. You would be sentenced to mandatory 5 years.
Not as many words as you just said, but something close to that, Your Honor. I see my red light has come on. I don't have a lot of other argument to offer other than
Let me ask you this question. If a defendant pled guilty to a charge with a mandatory minimum based on the 500 grams, but the PSR later found he was responsible for 100 grams, the mandatory minimum wouldn't apply, would it, just because he agreed to it in the plea agreement?
No, there has to be the district court has to find, of course, that the conspiracy involved at least 500 grams and that. And I guess I would leave you with this. I cited in my brief, United States versus Easter, at 523, this court said, in fact, statutory minimums do not hinge on the particular defendant's relevant conduct. And it goes on from there and talks about.
Judge Williams, may I ask one question?
Yeah, go ahead.
We sort of foreclosed your opportunity to respond to the Salem case and the second requirement now that the district judges have reminded of regarding the breadth of the conspiracy itself.
In that case, Your Honor, this court does talk about the adoption of the PSR, and in that case, the court adopted the PSR, but since it was upon clear error, that wasn't good enough. Here we are up on, you know, I argue waiver, but if not, certainly forfeiture. And this court talks about on plain error that probably would be enough. Her adoption of the PSR, I think, does get us to the well over 500 grams to trigger the 60-month mandatory minimum. And I would ask the court to affirm the judgment.
I want to just ask one question.
Yes,
as far
Your Honor.
As the size of this conspiracy, it seemed to me there are just lots of tentacles in it, weren't there? Lots of different things going on at one time, different places?
Well, I think this particular conspiracy, the grand jury returned an indictment against six people, plus Efren Pineda Buenaventura, who was just named as a co-conspirator. They all,
so
Efren was kind of in the middle. He was the hub, and then everybody else was kind of a spoke.
So is it about, when you say there's six in this or so?
I didn't bring a copy of the indictment up here, but that's my recollection, Your Honor.
Because as I understand, there were other parts of this that were bigger. I just wasn't sure.
There was, the grand jury interred actually two indictments sort of involving the Pineda Buenaventuras, and Efren was named in both, and Teodolo, the defendant in this case, was just named in this one.
All right,
thank you.
Your Honor. Mr. Handelsman, how much time? 2 minutes. And I'll give each counsel an additional minute. Government took a little more time, and we did ask you a lot of questions. You may proceed.
I'd like to take back what I said in the beginning about 22 additional deliveries. Quantities could not be determined. But the question that you're faced with is how much is in each of these 22 deliveries? If it was 1 or 2 or 3 grams, we still don't get to the 500 grams. Now, your cases, they're either in the reply brief or the initial brief, cited about 5 cases that say quantities must be determined conservatively. And if you don't know the amount of the deliveries, there could be 1,000 quantities. Well, maybe not 1,000, but maybe 30. But if you don't know the amount of the deliveries, they don't do us any good in seeing if the government got over 500 grams. Now, the prosecutor told you about what Efrain did, but there's nothing in this record that shows that Teodolo helped him out with any more than the 429 grams. This goes right to what you said in Salem. The scope of the relevant conduct is not necessarily the same as the scope of the entire conspiracy. The fact that Efrain, he could have been involved with 500 kilos, but unless Teodolo does something to help him out, and the record shows that, they don't help us in getting over that 500-gram quantity. Now, it's true, the indictment alleged 500 grams, but when counsel mentioned it, I was trying to flip through the plea agreement. I don't think it was part of the factual basis. Maybe later on you have a chance to go through it. You might see something, but from what I saw, it was not part of the factual basis. And also about saying the quantity wouldn't affect the outcome, that's the negligence that was talked about in Jaime's, and the other cases cited in the initial brief on plain waiver versus forfeiture. I think with all those cases and the discussion about negligence versus a deliberate and strategic decision, I think this record shows it was negligence, pure and simple. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Mr.?
Very briefly, Your Honor. Mr. Connell characterized what happened at this plea colloquy as Mr. Mendoza finally being led across the bridge. I don't think there was anything gentle about the way he was led across this bridge. And what concerns me on the face of this transcript is that he was kind of hammered into going across this bridge. And I would respectfully point out the conversation that is memorialized on page 22 of the plea transcript, where his own attorney is saying to him, did you ever do it just one time? You might have delivered CDs and DVDs, and the court says, I'm not interested in that. And defense counsel says, I understand. And the court says, I just want to know whether he ever delivered cocaine. Defense counsel, if there was ever one occasion, the court, ever, any occasion on which he delivered cocaine, I don't think there's anything gentle about that. And the fact that Mr. Mendoza finally says, okay, I might have done it one time, and I might have done it with this guy, after he's indicated that he'd done numerous things, including delivering things that were not cocaine to other people who he knew who are not any of the defendants named in this conspiracy. I don't think that's knowing and voluntary, and I'm very concerned with that language particularly.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Keister. Ms. Kelleher?
Briefly, Your Honors, I'd just like to address one comment that Mr. Connell made about the officers. Once they entered Apartment B, they almost immediately, I believe were the words he used, almost immediately realized their error and left. But that's not what the record shows. As Mr. Pineda-Soria was let out of his bedroom, at least two officers went past him into the bedroom. Depending on which officer was testifying, the officers were in the bedroom of Apartment B before they were ushered out, anywhere from 15 minutes to 30 minutes before they were ushered out and before they discovered from other occupants of Apartment A that Apartment B was, in fact, a separate apartment. We have no further questions.
Thank you, counsel, particularly Mr. Handelsman, Ms. Keister, and Ms. Kelleher. You're appointed. We thank you for your excellent briefs and oral argument and your representation of your clients. And, Mr. O'Connell, we know we can always rely on you. We thank you for, and we will take the case under advisement.